Thank you very much for that warmest welcome. I am delighted and honored to be here and continuing the informal NYU Cambridge Emmanuel connection. Thank you. Okay, so I'm going to be talking about first. We live in a world obsessed with firsts. Neil Armstrong is the first to walk on the moon. Amelia Earhart is the first woman to fly solo across the Atlantic Ocean. English surgeon Edward Jenner developed the world's first vaccine for smallpox. The Magna Carta is the first charter to limit a king's power by law. We celebrate the first to complete marathons and other races. And so I come before you today to talk about the notion of first in intellectual property law. And for those keeping count, I am not the first to speak or write about first, even in this context. Nor am I the first to claim that others writing in this area or speaking in this area have spoken about somewhat different aspects of this issue. Indeed, that seems to be the case here. I can therefore reasonably claim only that I am the first to write about my own take on first in the area of intellectual property. So I will first traverse the ways that first plays a role in intellectual property law, stopping off briefly at traditional property law, from which many of the rules of patent, copyright, and trademark are understood to derive. In traditional property and intellectual property, both, the notion of first possession is dominant in awarding rights. Okay, so pursuant to the common law, first possession determine property rights in an unowned resource, and we can trace the lineage of this critical principle in important part to John Locke, who wrote, "He that is nourished by the acorns he picked up under an oak or the apples he gathered from the trees in the wood has certainly appropriated them to himself. I ask then, when did they begin to be his? And 'tis plain if the first gathering made them not his, nothing else could." First possession's central role in property law is all but further assured by Blackstone's commentaries. Whoever was in occupation of any determinate spot of ground acquired for the time a sort of ownership. In the United States, and you'll forgive me all these references to the United States, it's where I come from, one commonly learns and explores this principle of first possession through a case called Pearson v. Post, an 1805 case about foxes. In that case, Lodowick Post had been out chasing a fox with his hounds when Jesse Pearson saw the fox, killed it, and carried it off. In the ensuing lawsuit over ownership of the fox, a majority of the Supreme Court of Judicature of New York sided with Pearson, reasoning that, quote, mere pursuit gave Post no legal right to the fox, but that he became the property of Pearson, who intercepted and killed him. The majority dismissed Post's argument on the ground that siding with one who has merely chased but not captured the animal would give rise to too many disputes. By contrast, the dissent would have ruled in favor of Post on the ground that his hot pursuit conferred ownership in accordance with hunting custom, especially because it encouraged hunters to rid foxes from the countryside. Yet the rule is that capture is possession and possession is ownership. While sometimes construing the particulars of possession differently depending on the context, courts have applied the rule that first possession is ownership to whales, water streams, sunken ships, oil, and many other contexts. Now let's turn from tangible resources, whales, foxes, and land, to the less tangible. Stories about whales, Herman Melville's Moby Dick, for example, inventions about foxes, like a new type of fox den, and brand names of land companies such as Cushman and Wakefield. Even though notions of traditional property are grounded in the physical world, they have found ready application in the world of the intangible, something property scholars Jesse Duke Manier, James Creer, and their casebook co-authors label acquisition by creation. First, patent law. Patent law generally exists to encourage scientific and technological innovation for society's benefit. American patent law grants protection to inventors of useful, novel, and non-obvious inventions. Patents are granted after successfully undergoing examination by the Patent and Trademark Office to ascertain that an invention is patentable, and the description in the patent application satisfies disclosure requirements. The patent right permits the patentee to exclude others from practicing the invention claimed in the patent for a limited time, typically 20 years from the date the application was filed. Suppose two inventors come up with the same invention. Patent law dictates that only one of them is entitled to a patent in the invention. Until 2012 in the United States, it was the person who was the first to invent. By contrast, patent law in almost every other country, including the United Kingdom, implies a first-to-file system awarding a patent to the first applicant to have filed. In 2012, the United States aligned itself more closely with these other countries, and once the law took effect, the first applicant to file for a patent would win the patent, except in a few circumstances, such as when a second filer was first to publicly disclose the invention. As such, US law is now principally a first-to-file system, like the rest of the world, but with minor remnants of a first-to-invent system. Okay, we therefore live in a first-to-file world. But how soon can one file for a patent? U.S. patent law allows filing only once the inventor is in possession of the invention, which is understood to be once the inventor has done something called reducing the invention to practice. Reduction to practice can be actual, in that the claimed invention works for its intended purpose, or constructive, merely by filing a patent application that satisfies the statutory disclosure requirements. Constructive reduction to practice means that patent filing can occur well before an actual prototype, let alone a commercialized product, has been made. Practically, this means that an inventor is considered first to possess an invention, even if the inventor never actually made the invention, so long as the patent document provides a sufficient roadmap to an expert in the field to do so. Legal and marketplace pressures encourage inventors to file for patents at an early juncture. The patent system's priority to the first to file encourages inventors to file applications expeditiously to avoid being blocked from getting a patent by a competing inventor. Moreover, the law's statutory bar to filing a patent more than 1 year after disclosure of one's invention, among other things, compels inventors to file quickly lest they bar themselves from obtaining a patent. In addition, there are marketplace pressures to rush the patent, and that patents serve as signals to venture capitalists and other funders that the inventions at issue are a worthy business investment. Does patent law require an inventor to have reduced to practice every possible embodiment of the invention they claim in their patent? For example, to take a silly example, if an inventor claims an invention of all light bulbs with a filament starting with the letter T, do they have to have made a light bulb with a tungsten filament, a tomato filament, a toad filament, a toffee filament, and so forth? Yes and no. Because an inventor need not actually reduce an invention to practice, they need not actually make a tungsten embodiment of the light bulb, let alone tungsten, tomato, toad, toffee, and so forth. Yet, as per the law's disclosure requirements, in the patent document, the inventor both needs to enable a person having ordinary skill in the art to make and use the invention without undue experimentation, and provide a written description that shows the inventor is in possession of the claimed invention. That is, the inventor must enable at least a substantial swath of the scope, if not the full scope, of the claimed invention by having constructively reduced to practice the invention in the patent document. What this means as a practical matter is that to be considered first to possess an invention, inventor must have enabled much, if not all, of the scope of their claimed invention. Not all scientific and engineering ingenuity can be possessed under patent law. As ingenious and revolutionary as Albert Einstein's theory of relativity may have been, he was not entitled to a patent for generating it. While US patent law allows patents on new useful and non-obvious processes, machines, manufacturers, or compositions of matter, courts have long excluded laws of nature, natural phenomena, and abstract ideas from patentability. As Rochelle Dreyfus and James Evans explain, this rule is in large part about timing. Quote, patent claims cannot be made too early in the development of a field because there is a danger of preemption. Exclusive rights may preempt others from competing and thereby diminish the vibrancy of the marketplace or the vigor of the creative environment. Early claiming can pose an obstacle to the onward march of science or business, and it does so by limiting the number of approaches, experiences, bodies of knowledge, and interests that can be brought to bear in mining the initial insight. By requiring that an abstract idea or a law of nature be refined to a machine or applied method, downstream innovation of ideas or theories is kept more open to all. Likely for similar reasons about timing and preemption, courts have held that an invention lacks the utility it needs to be patentable until a specific benefit exists in currently available form, even if that benefit is largely suspected. As the U.S. Supreme Court concluded in the canonical case on utility, recalling the fox in the Pearson case, quote, a patent is not a hunting license. It is not a reward for the search, but compensation for its successful conclusion. Based on these doctrines of patentable subject matter and utility, being first to possess an invention requires sufficient downstream refinement and establishment of a specific utility. Patent law also disqualifies some, and sometimes anyone, from being first to possess an invention. Inventions must be novel to be patentable. With limited exception, U.S. patent law disqualifies someone from getting a patent if the claimed invention was patented, described in a patented printed publication, or in public use, on sale, or otherwise available to the public before the filing date of the claimed invention. Legally, then, in the face of such prior art, that person's not first. That does not necessarily mean that the first comer is first themselves in the eyes of patent law, entitled to a patent, for they too might be disqualified for having disclosed or placed their invention on sale too long without filing for a patent. Relatedly, patent law prohibits an inventor from getting a patent on their invention if it's considered to be an obvious, insignificant leap forward in light of the prior art. In these ways, patent law erases some from being considered first. On the other end of the spectrum, patent law also sometimes deploys legal fiction to deem some to be first when they're not. For one thing, U.S. patent law allows an inventor's filing of continuation applications to claim matter disclosed and enabled by a pre-existing application of the inventor, but more broadly with a different focus or otherwise than claimed in the underlying application. Even though the application postdates the initial application, it is treated as though filed on the date of the prior application. So a person can be considered to be the first in possession of an invention, even if they did not realize they were in possession of the invention at the time they filed an initial application and only realized as much later on. For another thing, through something called the doctrine of equivalence, patent law allows a patentee to claim those insubstantial alterations that were not captured in drafting the original patent claim, but which could be created through trivial changes so long as they don't intrude on the prior art. Because the scope of the doctrine of equivalence is assessed when measuring patent infringement, it often encompasses later developed technologies, which the inventor never actually possessed at the time of invention. It is therefore another fictional first in patent law, allowing a patentee to be deemed to be first to possess a technology that never existed when the patentee claimed possession. Okay, as this synthesis of patent law and doctrine demonstrates, it's not straightforward to translate the notion of first possession from the physical realm of property, where it already raises knotty questions, to the world of the intangible. Copyright law presents another variation on this theme, to which I now turn. So copyright law's goals are similar to patents, although directed at artistic works rather than scientific and technological works. And while its goals are in large part utilitarian, this body of law is also concerned with an author's moral rights. U.S. copyright law protects original works of authorship fixed in a tangible medium of expression, including literary works, sound recordings, movies, and computer software code. To obtain copyright protection, authors need only create a qualifying work, and then a copyright holder receives the exclusive right to reproduce the work, distribute copies of it, and prepare derivative works, among other things, typically until 70 years after the author's death. Copyright law is more generous than patent law in deeming creators to be first possessors and therefore rights holders. So the U.S. Supreme Court's most recent formulation of copyright law's originality requirement occurred in a case called Feist Publications versus Rural Telephone Service Company, a case involving the copyrightability of something we don't typically see anymore, a local telephone directory listing names in alphabetical order, along with their towns and telephone numbers. The Feist Court held that work is original so long as it was independently created by the author as opposed to being copied from other works, and that it possesses at least some minimal degree of creativity. The requisite level of creativity, according to the Supreme Court, is extremely low. Even a slight amount will suffice. A work must merely evidence intellectual production, thought, and conception. originality does not match up to a requirement of novelty. With regard to this requirement of independent creation, the emphasis is on the personal discovery of a subjective problem that artists express in their work. Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes recognized this much in one of the U.S. Supreme Court's most notable copyright decisions, Bleistein versus Donaldson Lithographic Company. In holding a color poster advertising a circus to be copyrightable, Justice Holmes wrote that the creation of an artistic work, quote, is the personal reaction of an individual upon nature. Personality always contains something unique, he said. It expresses its singularity even in handwriting, and a very modest grade of art has in it something irreducible, which is one man's alone. That's something he may copyright. As Judge Learned Hand observed, if by some magic a man who had never known it were to compose anew Kate's Ode on a Grecian Urn, he would be an author. And if he copyrighted it, others might not copy that poem, though they might, of course, copy Kate's. It is thus the rare work that will not meet the low threshold of originality. For example, the court held that the telephone directory in Feist was insufficiently original because its factual raw data did not owe its existence to the directory creator, and the selection and alphabetical arrangement of the directory entries was not creative enough. The threshold for protection is therefore minimal but not absent. Copyright law's understanding of originality suggests that as long as the creator is not copying existing work, and there is at least a tiny spark of creativity, the creator is the first to possess that creation and thus gets copyright protection for it. The terminology of originality might suggest that it is harder to be the first to possess a work under copyright law than is actually the case given the legal understanding of originality. So as with patent law, copyright law deems the creator of an original work of authorship to be the first possessor of other works that might not have been created yet pursuant to the copyright holder's exclusive rights. That is through the reproduction right, which encompasses substantially similar works, and the right to prepare derivative works. Both rights confer first possession on a copyright holder who might never have created and never will create works that fall within these more extensive rights. In so doing, copyright law also creates a legal fiction as to first possession. Copyright law also dismisses some possessors from its ambit. Most prominently, copyright protection extends to the expression of particular ideas rather than to the ideas themselves. For example, the expression in a play about star-crossed lovers would be copyrightable, but the idea of star-crossed lovers would not. As the U.S. Supreme Court has explained, ideas are excluded from the scope of copyright protection so that they can be left free for all to use as building blocks to create further expression. U.S. courts attribute this principle in particular to protecting First Amendment free speech values. Now, trademark law. So while trademark law is grounded in different principles than patent and copyright law, it shares the difficulty of translating property law's principles of first possession to the intangible world. Trademark protection strives to bolster trade by identifying a product as satisfactory and thereby stimulating further purchases by the consuming public. Scholars theorize that producers of trademark goods will have the incentive to invest in the good's quality. Protecting against trademark infringement from this vantage point thus prevents others from trading on the goodwill represented by the trademark. Words, symbols, logos, and sometimes a product's design or packaging may be protected under trademark law. According to U.S. law, these are protectable so long as they're used by a person in commerce to identify and distinguish goods from those manufactured or sold by others, and to indicate the source of the goods, even if that source is unknown. The law similarly protects marks that designate services. And the law protects these trademark holders against another's use in commerce of a mark that's likely to cause confusion among consumers. In the United States, both registered and unregistered marks are protected because protection is premised upon use in commerce, which is bona fide use of a mark in the ordinary course of trade, to be contrasted with token uses to secure protection. To discern whether the requisite use in commerce is present, U.S. courts look to whether there is use that is sufficiently public. Priority is conferred upon the first to use a mark. How geographically broad one's priority is depends on whether the mark has been registered. registered marks, which require a demonstration to the U.S. Trademark Office that the mark is protectable and that an identical or sufficiently similar mark is not already in use in a way that would confuse consumers, they get many advantages under trademark law, among them nationwide constructive use conferring priority throughout the country. Even if the mark's not being used pervasively throughout the country, trademark law deploys a legal fiction here, construing use and thus first possession where nothing has truly been possessed. No such fiction, is deployed for unregistered marks. The owner of an unregistered mark has priority only in the geographic area where the marked products or services are being sold or advertised, or where the mark's reputation has been established. By contrast with the United States, many other jurisdictions, including the European Union and the United Kingdom, deem the first possessor of a mark to be the first file to register the mark in the jurisdiction's trademark office, even if they're not yet using the mark. For example, an EU trademark registrant enjoys a 5-year grace period from the date of registration to make a genuine use of its mark for the goods or services specified in the registration. The United States recently has made a small step to accord its trademark law with these first-to-file countries by granting some protection to a business's mark if it has a bona fide intention to use the mark in commerce and applies to register it, and registration is complete upon actual use. Okay, so by contrast to patent and copyright laws, trademark rights are not rights in gross. That is, trademark rights only exist in relation to the goods or services with which they are used. And so while trademark rights may be enforced against a somewhat broader range of uses, the rights remain anchored in the claimant's use. In this sense, first possession has a narrower scope than analogously in patent and copyright. Trademark law also rebuffs the use of symbols that are not distinctive as possession giving rise to legal rights despite first use in commerce. As trademark scholar Barton Beebe explains, a trademark is distinctive of source if it's recognized by consumers as a designation of the source of the product to which it's affixed, rather than, say, a decoration or a description of that product. This source distinctiveness is also known as secondary meaning, as this association between source and product supplements the mark's linguistic primary meaning, as a word, image, or the like. Protectability turns on distinctiveness because consumers would never be likely to be confused as to source unless they recognize a particular designation as source indicating in the first place. So generic terms can never be distinctive. Terms that are descriptive of their goods or services can become distinctive if they acquire secondary meaning. And other terms, terms suggestive of or arbitrary in relation to their goods and services, as well as coin terms, are inherently distinctive. As with the conferral of nationwide priority on registered marks, trademark law also deems businesses to be first comers when they change their marks over time to rebrand. As long as the modified mark continues to create the same continuing commercial impression as the previous mark, such that consumers would generally regard them as the same, the mark owner gets the benefit of the priority date of the initial mark. Okay, so with this synthesis of the way notions of first possession are construed, fictionalized, and applied across the law of property and intangibles, I want to now turn to analyze this constellation of concepts of first in intellectual property. So these foregoing descriptions of patent, copyright, and trademark laws show how clumsy it is to construe them as rules of first possession. Even though these laws intellectually descend from traditional property rules, where first possession is the paramount rule, by applying this principle to the intangibles of inventions, creative works, and brands, the rules of first possession, which are already difficult to construe and apply in certain traditional property scenarios, become even harder to fit. Intellectual property laws are led down this awkward path by virtue of thinking about patent, copyright, and trademark laws as being types of property. Deeming first possession to extend beyond anything a creator or initiator has done in the physical world is one important distortion, fictionalization, or at least a significant extension of property laws, rules, and notion of first possession. Patent, copyright, and trademark laws each do this in numerous ways. In particular, patent law permits this constructive reduction to practice and provides a right to exclude over the entire scope of the claimed invention, which is unlikely to have been physically made in each possible variation, so long as the disclosure requirements are met. It further deploys legal fictions to deem a continuation of an initial patent application to be in the inventor's possession. First, just as with the initial application, and to deem equivalence of a claimed invention the inventor never conceived to be part of the invention they possess. Similarly, copyright law provides a creator with rights well beyond the actual creative work they have originated to include substantially similar works and derivative works. Copyright law also has a very different view than patent law and traditional property law of what first means by theoretically, at least, allowing two creators of identical works to each get copyright protection for it so long as one has not copied the other. And trademark law provides protection in a mark over a geographic scope where a business might not even be using a mark, just as many jurisdictions permit registration of a mark without use anywhere in the jurisdiction. Moreover, the law provides rights in marks that a business is not using if they would be likely to confuse consumers if used by someone else. And it permits businesses to change their marks in many ways and still claim early first possession. These are all massive distortions of how we ordinarily understand the notion of first, as in first to complete a marathon or first in line. And it causes one to wonder whether first in intellectual property law still has much helpful meaning at all. Is it stretched so thin that it can't be a helpful concept if one can label so many non-first behaviors as first? For example, with a very elastic understanding of first, I can pronounce with a straight face that the person who performs best over a 10-year competition is the first to be the best and is therefore first. That does not seem to be what we usually understand first to mean. Of course, if one returns to the basic principles of patent, copyright, and trademark laws, encouraging innovation, encouraging the production of artistic and cultural works, and fair competition, and perhaps protecting creators' moral rights, one sees that these laws have a very different occupation than traditional property law. They're generally about providing incentives to individuals and businesses to shape their behavior, to encourage the production of certain intangibles, which are different in many important ways than tangibles. As much as patent, copyright, and trademark law are first cousins to traditional property law, they are trying to accomplish something different. So it might not be surprising how much intellectual property laws have to be distorted to match property law's principle of first possession. By asserting a kinship to property with its grounding in first possession, intellectual property laws also become obsessed with the idea of first. It is important to wonder whether there's a better way to decide who gets rights and intangibles. On this side of the pond, I'm not sure if you're as familiar with the children's rhyme, first is the worst, second is the best, third is the one with the treasure chest along with some crasser variations. In that vein, should intellectual property laws be wondering about awarding rights to the best party when that is not the first to come up with some invention, creative work, or brand? What is best? And first is first as to what? And why does the third comer get the treasure chest and the children's rhyme, a topic for another day perhaps? Relatedly, one can wonder whether a gravitation toward first as the deciding factor in who gets awarded intellectual property rights is a way to avoid making a substantive decision about who's the optimal awardee of the right. Is it the one who would be the fourth one to make a type of cancer drug by getting the drug to work on more people with the fewest side effects? Is it the 131st story of boy meets girl, boy loses girl, boy gets girl back, which happens to have the largest audience and the highest number of positive reviews? Is it the business that would use a particular mark across the widest market to get the greatest consumer recognition? We can invoke many different markers of success. And in some ways, gravitating instead toward first as the determinative marker alone avoids the law having to make a substantive decision about what is good, let alone optimal. Of course, by omission, choosing first as the principle makes a substantive decision of a kind nonetheless. So some scholars think that the affinity between intellectual and traditional property is critical, and that first possession ought to serve as the basis for intellectual property rights. For example, Dotan Oliar and James Stern analyze how first possession principles do and ought to animate the intellectual property laws. While I do not think that applying notions of first possession ought to be rejected out of hand, it's not clear that they can be applied in any straightforward way in intellectual property or that they ought to be. Yet it is important to understand what work they are doing in traditional property to decide whether their underlying principles are worth importing into intellectual property. Property scholar Carol Rose, tracing her thinking back to Blackstone, understands first possession not necessarily to be an act that's intrinsically valued, but even so can be understood as useful labor. She says, quote, "The useful labor is the very act of speaking clearly and distinctly about one's claim to property. Naturally, this must be in a language that is understood, and the acts of possession that communicate a claim will vary according to the audience. Thus, to Rose, the majority in Pearson v. Post, our Fox case, sees possession as, quote, a clear act whereby all the world understands the possessor has an unequivocal intention of appropriating the animal to his individual use. A clear rule of the sort should be applied, said the court, because it prevents confusion and quarreling among hunters and, coincidentally, makes the judge's task easier when hunters do get into quarrels. Rose finds this principle to thread throughout property law, and she concludes that if I keep my property claims clear, others will know that they should deal with me directly if they want to use my property. We can bargain rather than fight. Through trade, all items will come to rest in the hands of those who value them most. Doton Olear and James Stern understand first possession somewhat differently. They say that one of the clearest ways to make sense of the seeming hodgepodge of possessory rules is to think about them in terms of a common metric, time. Each of these possessory principles can usefully be placed on a chronology, starting with the first preliminary steps necessary to appropriate a resource and ending when the resource is consumed, commercialized, or otherwise put into use. They see property law generally deeming either first committed searchers to be the first possessor or the capturer to be the first possessor. And to decide between the two approaches, it's about reflecting how the balance between the relative pros and cons of early and late awards changes for different resources along the course of their acquisition. If one awards rights too early to a chaser, the chaser may own the resource but have failed to complete the chase, so the resource is underused and thus misallocated. In that sense, later in time is better in deciding the first possessor. On the other hand, rights awarded to a capturer might yield excessive and wasteful investment in resource search and pursuit, including when a pursuer who does not successfully capture the resource ends up empty-handed, which can discourage them from pursuing in the first place. So keeping these concepts underlying first possession on hand and also bearing in mind that we must address first as to what and whether there might be a better answer than first, it is worth setting out what factors might be particularly relevant to patent, copyright, and trademark. And there are many cross-cutting factors which probably cannot be all satisfied simultaneously in an award of rights. One thing intellectual property laws all care about is about providing clear notice to the world that a particular individual or business has rights and what scope their rights cover. It's critical for third parties to know when rights have been granted so they know which spaces are off limits and which are not. Third parties can also know with whom to negotiate when they would like to license or buy these rights. Government entities also need clear notice to evaluate protectability. And from this perspective, it would seem sooner awards of rights are typically better than later ones. Yet that might be too simplistic. Even despite the desirability of clear notice, it can be quite challenging to provide this notice with regard to intangibles because we can't point to them or always easily demarcate their bounds or even have good vocabulary to talk about them when they are new things. Perhaps we can show an invention prototype or a book or a trademark on a sneaker. But how well does that signal the often wide swath of invisible related matter that is protected by the same right? We often have to extrapolate a broader scope of rights from a limited number of tangible items or turn to fully verbal descriptions of that scope. From the perspective of clearly demarcating this hard to describe class of items protected by a right, later in time might be better, because greater clarity might derive from greater refinement and development of a variety of protected matter. This refinement might also provide better vocabulary to describe protected works. So awarding rights to someone who has a clear vision for their creation, which might not be the first comer, might yield the clearest notice, even if not the earliest. Another important facet of intellectual property laws is that they tend to yield things that society values, at least when the laws function as intended. We get medicines, software, movies, songs, and branded goods from which we can benefit. In that sense, one might suggest that the sooner we as a society get these wonderful things, the better. Society then can consume them and learn from them to the end of further innovation as well. Moreover, competition spurred by a desire to make something first might spur faster and faster development for society's benefit too. At the same time, we often associate shoddy production with rush production. So having businesses race as quickly as possible to yield new products might not be ideal. Moreover, the first to have an insight that produces a new product is not always going to make the best version of that product, let alone its numerous possible variations. In these ways, society might benefit more from patience and not awarding rights, especially broad ones, to the first comer. And even when it does award rights to the first comer, intellectual property laws might want to remain mindful of finding ways to provide supplemental or substitutive rights to later comers who do a better job than the first comer. Finally, the choice of a particular rule over one over others in deciding possession of intellectual property can affect how motivated individuals are to create works. In other work, I have termed expressive incentives to be the ways in which copyright and patent laws can protect creators, labor and personhood interests, and employ rhetoric communicating concern for these interests. One can hypothesize that deeming someone to be first to conceive an idea, first to actualize a work, or best to do either of these might motivate creators, though perhaps differentially. And it's something we might want to keep in mind. So with these factors in mind, let's now turn back to patent, copyright, and trademark, respectively. Patent. So the two industries that most frequently come to mind these days in thinking about patent law, pharmaceuticals and software, conjure up very different images of the pace and shape of innovation. In the pharmaceutical industry, one hears about the painstaking process of drug development. To be more concrete, a recent US study estimated that developing a new drug takes more than 10 years and $2.6 billion. By contrast, even though this notion is perhaps growing out of favor, Silicon Valley has long suggested to move fast and break things. Despite the differences, both contexts are very much about racing to be the first to innovate something. To a large extent, patent law accords with these notions by awarding sole patent rights to the first filer to have completed an invention by having reduced it to practice. One can't wait too long before heading to the patent office because otherwise you might be preempted by someone else, let alone your own activities. The filer must be able to delineate and demonstrate possession of the invention to qualify for the rights, thereby providing rights only so long as clear notice can be provided. Yet by allowing filers to rely on constructive reduction to practice, as well as prophetic rather than real examples, applicants can secure a patent without possessing a tangible instantiation of their claimed invention. The invention therefore might not be fully refined, thereby conferring rights on someone who has not come far enough along in possessing the invention. Put another way, patent law might block others with the talent and capacity to fully complete the invention from doing so and obtaining rights for doing so. And in some ways, patent law does try to balance these competing concerns in an era of patent trolls and major and foundational scientific advances in genetics, for example. Patent law blocks those with only abstract ideas or scientific principles from patenting by deeming these not to be patentable subject matter. It concludes an invention is not useful until it has specific and substantial utility. These doctrines send a message that if one wants to get a patent on software or genetic technologies, one must advance the work beyond an abstract idea or scientific principle to an application, a machine, a composition of matter, or a process, and so forth. At the same time, aspects of patent law do tacitly move the law away from only focusing on first. If someone invents an improvement to an invention, they can separately patent it, even if there's a patent on the underlying invention. For example, if I'm the first to come up with a rocking chair, I can patent it even if there's a patent on the underlying chair as invention. I can't make a rocking chair without getting a license from the patent holder for the chair, and that patent holder cannot make a rocking chair without getting a license from me. In this way, we have what's known as blocking patents. Economic theory suggests in this situation that we should negotiate a deal to share profits in rocking chairs, allowing each other to proceed. Of course, transaction costs, animosity, or other factors might hold up such a deal, yet patent law enables this to happen Moving the law toward a hybrid system of first and best. Better inventions can partially disrupt the patent rights of firstcomers. It might not be an ideal way to encourage the creation of better inventions, especially when the improver has to share disproportionate profits with a middling firstcomer, but it is a step in that direction. Yet with its sterile rules for contribution qualifying for a patent, novelty, utility, and non-obviousness, patent law is not always awarding patents to the best innovator, but rather to one who has made a new, even less good, innovative step. Patent law might profit by focusing more on a judging invention's merit to make sure that the better inventions are being encouraged into existence. Now consider copyright law. It also mixes first with best more than it might seem at first glance. By allowing so many to be first possessors so long as they do not copy, it feels just right for our era of the participation trophy. Everyone gets one regardless of the place in which they finish. There can be valid copyrights in each of 5 tornado disaster movies or thousands of pop songs about heartbreak, and they can duke it out for best in the marketplace. The one way in which this cannot easily come to fruition is in the context of copyright's broad rights in derivative works. Here, there can only indeed be 9 Spider-Man movies, but only pursuant to the permission of the underlying copyright holder in the Spider-Man comic books. This might be reasonable if we think that Spider-Man may never exist in the first place if the comic book author does not have control over downstream movies, toys, and so forth, and that the 9 Spider-Man movies we have gotten are perfect, and we would not benefit as a society to have others. Yet we might benefit from having more such movies created out of the control of the original copyright holder. Through carve-outs for fair use or other infringement exceptions, though these can enable some such films, copyright law otherwise does make it hard to accomplish this and might be undermining the creation of best. By contrast with copyright law, trademark law takes the notion of first very seriously, even as it distorts it to treat things that never happened or happened later as first too. Even so, by disallowing rights in gross, it allows many businesses to use the same literal mark with regard to different categories of goods and services, deeming them each to be first in their subspace. Yet it could be more sensitive to optimizing competition and consumer interest by not merely doling out marks to whichever business happens to get there first. To take one example from the United States, a local limousine service in Gainesville, Florida, had been using Uber as its mark for some time when the ride-hailing service came on the scene throughout the country with the same name. The first comer has a plausible claim under trademark law for confusion, known as reverse confusion, because many consumers become confused that the first comer is actually the second comer, rather than the other way around, which is usually the case with trademark infringement. On the one hand, this is as it should be. First comers get trademark rights and they should not be stomped out by mega businesses. On the other hand, it would not be out of line to ask whether it might be more efficient for the Uber ride-hailing service to be able to use its same mark everywhere because it's using the mark more broadly while compensating the first comer to rebrand or coexist. Similarly, in an age of trademark depletion, running out of trademarks, one might ask whether markets might be divided to allow more concurrent use of marks, and whether marks being ineffectively used might be reappropriated to a more effective user. To the extent that trademark law continues to rely on a system of first, it also might be well advised to reconsider protecting those with descriptive marks who are the first to establish secondary meaning. As I explore in other work, there are competitive concerns with protecting marks that bear a close conceptual connection to the associated good or service, even if consumers associate the mark with a particular source. Moreover, awarding rights to the first comer to develop secondary meaning in a descriptive term gives outsized influence to businesses with greater means to spend on advertising and such to achieve secondary meaning and thereby monopolize a competitively advantageous descriptive term. So in conclusion, last but not least, intellectual property laws would do well to come to terms with the fact that they are not and cannot be straightforwardly implementing first possession rules from traditional property. There are so many complex choices patent, copyright, and trademark laws need to make to decide to whom to award rights, even if it adopts a first model. And by adopting a first model, these laws often de-emphasize awards to the best, perhaps as a way to avoid difficult decisions of what is indeed best. That said, these laws could do a bit more grappling directly with what is best as a way to promote the progress that these laws seek to promote. Thank you.